All right, if you're anything like me, you hate running out of food on a trip. It's like a big fear. And so I'm a big fan of snacks during an adventure. And one of my absolute favorite go-to snacks are Wonderful Pistachios. You may be familiar with pistachios and the brand Wonderful Pistachios, but if you're not, they are one of the highest protein nuts out there. 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios is 6 grams of protein. That's 10% of your daily value. It also includes 9 essential amino acids, and they come with a ton of different flavors, varieties. There's a spicy version, there's lightly salted, there's no salted, there's so many. And every time I go on an adventure, I'm not even lying, I take an entire bag with me. And what's cool too, I love having the Wonderful Pistachio in shell, because then that almost gives me something to do and focus on as I'm paddling or biking through the really monotonous parts of the adventure. Every great adventure is going to have plenty of boring moments, and it's nice to have something to do and also something that is giving you some fuel, like Wonderful Pistachios. So they're one of my favorite adventure snacks, favorite road trip snacks, and definitely leave me feeling better than a lot of other snacks you can turn to. So if you want to learn more about how to fuel your next adventure with Wonderful Pistachios, go to WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. Today's episode is a throwback. We're going back to one of my earlier episodes, so, you know, I've hopefully improved since then. But this is going back talking to Adrian Garza, the dude that climbs up volcanoes. He lives in Mexico City, climbs to the top of these like 18,000 foot volcanoes and just jumps off with a paraglide. Of course, you know, he's not to his death. It's an amazing combination of skills and experiences, and just something that I imagine would just blow the minds of people 300,000-500,000 years ago, of like, one day humans will fly and this is how they're going to do it. Like, what an amazing, like, I don't even know the word, just magical, majestic, celestial, spiritual experience to say, I'm going to climb this mountain and then fly off of it like a bird. That's what Adrian's doing. I've never experienced this. I have no idea what it feels like or, you know, the sensation, but it's just one of the coolest things I've ever heard of. It was such a great conversation. I actually love to have Adrian back on the show to hear about what he's done since. But this was just a really fun conversation that I remember being kind of one of those eye-opening experiences. And again, you know, folks, if you listen to this show, you know that, you know, you can't pursue everything. You know, we hear so many types of sports, so many different types of adventures that you can do. Obviously, you can't do all these. And I'm frankly very surprised when I think someone who is very adventurous, I'm like, oh yeah, they've probably tried everything. And then you get to talking to them and they haven't done the vast majority of sports, you know, adventure sports, that is. I'm that person. You know, I haven't paraglided, I haven't scuba dived, I haven't done so many things, but these ideas and hearing these stories are so interesting because it at least keeps you willing to look at new things and new perspectives. It gives you ideas. It helps you think outside the box and helps you honestly fall in love even deeper with the thing that you know you already enjoy. Right now for me, paddle boarding is so important to me. Fossil hunting is super important. Those are kind of two things that I just do any chance I get, and it changes over time, and that's okay. It depends on where you are in life, depends on your budget, depends on the time you have to do things. It depends on where physically you are in the world, but find whatever that is. Maybe it's paragliding off of volcanoes. Maybe it's just walking in the flattest woods you can imagine and just enjoying that and focusing on the small things. I'll share a quick story, then we'll jump in because I don't know why. I'm just rambling today. I went on a hike recently and I saw this crowd of people, you know, gathered around something. And I'm like, what's going on? And everybody was down on their knees looking at these two dung beetles pushing around this little piece of like rabbit poop. And the beetles were working together to move this thing down the trail. And they were making pretty dang good progress. And I just remember being so happy and so, just really content that, like, wow, human beings are fascinated by the micro hiking, the things, the little things. It's not just the big vistas and big adventures. It can be something that small, that's unique and fascinating and gets your attention and makes it a really valuable experience for you involved. And I just love that there was like 20 people around these two little beetles pushing poop around. Like, you know, it sounds ridiculous when I start talking about it, but being there, I'm like, wow, all these little magical moments and, you know, creatures doing what they're supposed to do and made to do, it's all around us. And if we stopped to explore it and to appreciate it, it really adds a lot to life. So whatever gets you to do that and appreciate nature and appreciate life and this journey we're on, do that thing as much as you can and bring others with you. Like I said, it doesn't have to be paragliding off volcanoes. It can be sauntering in the woods. It can be bikepacking. It can be through hiking. It can be anything. Just find it and go and, you know, wear a helmet. All right, let's dive in. Everybody, welcome to the show. Today we are doing something really, really out of the box. It's not a Life Outside the Box episode, but actually it might be because this is pretty crazy. Adrian Garza is a hike and basically a hike and fly paragliding. Climb a mountain, well, in his case, a volcano, and freaking just fly off of it. Adrian, welcome to the show, man.
That's the idea. Thank you, Mason. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, you just got off work. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you just explain, like, what is this sport that you do? Because I don't think a lot of people are familiar with it.
Yeah, of course. So my background is more in rock climbing first, and then high altitude mountaineering. Around Mexico City, we have volcanoes that are, you know, over 15,000 feet. So it's a pretty good athletic challenge just to hike up there, even with a lead pack on. And then one day, you know, I had seen this documentary about Cedar Wright, who was a climber, doing this paragliding flight off the summit of the tallest mountain in Mexico. It's a volcano called Pico de Orizaba. And at that point, he was still a beginner in terms of paragliding, even though he was a pro climber for many years. And I'd been on that volcano before several times. And that idea kind of was, you know, stuck in the back of my mind. And then one day my wife came back from a trip to Peru, and she went on a tandem flight in Lima. And she loved it, and she wanted to explore paragliding and learning together. So I thought, you know, it would be great if I could combine what I'm already doing, which is hiking up these high volcanoes, and then flying from the summit. And that's what I set out to do when I started taking lessons along with her.
Holy cow. Now I'm looking, the mountain you just mentioned is 18,000, almost 18,500 feet.
Exactly, yes.
And you haven't been doing this very long.
I have not. So we started taking lessons in May 2017, and then I got my license in January of 2018, last year, a little over a year ago. And in order to get a license to be able to fly by yourself away from your home site, you have to have at least 30 flights. And there's a practical exam and a theoretical exam, and of course the actual lessons. So my flight number 31 was a hike and fly from one of these volcanoes here in Mexico, which is another one called, it's a complicated name, it's called Iztaccíhuatl. So they call him Ista for short, and it's a little more over 17,000 feet. It's also pretty high. It's the third highest in Mexico.
Man, that is crazy. It's like you get your driver's license and you jump straight into like Formula One racing. Like you got your license and just took off. Like, holy cow, that's crazy, man. So your wife got you into this. And now does she still do this with you, or have you kind of done it on your own?
She hasn't been doing it because we recently had a baby.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. We have almost 3 months old now.
Boy or girl?
Yeah, girl.
All right.
Baby girl.
Congrats.
Yeah.
I've got one on the way in a couple months. So.
Oh, congratulations.
First time. So, yeah. I'll have to get some tips from you, man, because I'm scared to death I won't have time to do anything anymore.
Yeah, that's scarier than flying off a volcano for sure. Being the first kid.
That's funny. Dang, man. So she's taking a break because y'all had a baby girl, and but you're still doing it.
Yeah, still found a way to keep doing it. My last hike and fly trip was late November last year, and that was on another kind of subsidiary summit of Ista in a more remote part of the volcano, which is not as frequented as the normal route to the primary summit.
Right.
It's a place that's more remote, and when I was there, I was the only person around. But the interesting thing for me about that trip was that I could manage to do it in a single day as a round trip from Mexico City there and back without having to spend the night on the mountain. So, you know, being a new father and still adapting to all this, it was a lot easier for me to find a place where I could go out and come back the same day.
Did you go to work the next day?
I did it on a Saturday, so I got out of the day to recover.
So people ask you what you did that weekend, you're like, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, I think my colleagues are a little used to it by now, but at first it was quite surprising.
Man, I can't believe it. I bet they think you're crazy.
Yeah, it could look like that from the outside. But I'm actually very cautious. And that's something that my wife and my mom are very grateful for. And they come to understand that. So they rest a little easier now. They've gotten to know how I approach these things.
So how... What do you look for when you go up a mountain? Do you do your research beforehand, and what kind of things do you have to watch out for?
Yeah, I try to be as familiar as I can with the actual place. So all of these volcanoes that I've flown from are places that I've previously climbed at least once, and most of them are more than once, up to 10 or more times. I think for me, I mean, unless you're going with a guide, you know, on a guided hike and fly trip, I think it's first and foremost, you have to be comfortable being on the mountain and being up on a high mountain and being up high on that specific mountain and carrying a heavy backpack. So I try to add as few new variables to the equation at a time as possible. So for example, I wouldn't recommend somebody do this and be their first time at high elevation, and also the first time on that mountain, and also their first time carrying a big backpack, and also their first time flying alone, etc. So I tried to gradually add all of those new variables, you know, one at a time if possible, so that when it comes time to actually hike up and fly off, you're already familiar and comfortable with most of the aspects of what you're going to do.
My goodness, man, that is so crazy. That is so cool, though. That is amazing. Like, what a cool idea. Now, do you know anyone else doing this that can you go with, or are you kind of just alone in your community, in your network?
There are people that have done this as well. And I actually talked to some of the people that flew off of ISTA, you know, to get some data from them, to get information about how they approached it and where they took off. And there's also a platform where people can upload their flights, their paragliding flights. So the flights from ISTA from this team are on there. Cedar Wright's flight from Orizaba is on there as well, so you can actually look at the track. So, and I've seen, you know, other videos of other people doing this. I know, I mean, for sure that from ISTA and Orizaba, other people have flown. But then some of the other ones that I've flown from, I don't know of anyone else that has flown from those places. So at least two of the volcanoes that I've flown from, they're possibly the first flight from those. Wow. It's at least the first documented flight. And now to get back to your question, there aren't that many people that do this. And I think, well, the first reason is there aren't really that many paraglider pilots in Mexico to begin with. I mean, it's a country of like 125 million people. And there's maybe, I mean, someone told me once that around maybe 500 pilots. Maybe by now, that was like 2 years ago, maybe there's more than that. But I'm pretty sure it's less than 1,000 pilots in the whole country.
Wow.
And then of those pilots, the people that are actually interested in climbing up to 18,000 feet, probably a really small fraction of those. And then also to do this, it helps a lot if you have equipment that's lighter than the regular equipment so that you can actually carry it all the way up. You also probably need to have, you know, dedicated hike and fly equipment. So there's harnesses that are made for that are lighter with, you know, different kinds of materials. And the wings themselves also, they're becoming more and more popular, and they're made from, you know, a slightly lighter cloth, and they have different materials on the webbing that attaches to the harness and stuff like that. So it's unless somebody has kind of like the specific idea of getting into it, kind of like I did. So I chose my equipment to be functional for that kind of stuff. Mm. It's going to be hard to find someone that would be capable and willing and has the right equipment to do it. So there's, it's part of what really attracts me to it here is that it's so few people doing it and so few people doing it here that there's a lot of things to be done that nobody's ever done before. So you actually feel like you really are on an adventure, right? You're exploring and doing things that haven't been done before. And there's no real reference that you can go to just copy and replicate.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. Are you looking to sell anything at all online? Well, I would advise you to look into Shopify. They are a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. I use Shopify every day at my day job. It has been with us since our company was a tiny little team all the way up to where we are today, one of the biggest breweries in the country. Whether you're auctioning off autographed apparel, selling sleek skis, or selling non-alcoholic beer like we are at Athletic Brewing, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their personal POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. We manage a podcast, a blog, all that right there on our Shopify store. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and has extensive help resources whenever you're dealing with an obstacle. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ASP, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ASP for Adventure Sports Podcast now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ASP. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. Seems like a pretty niche sport, and the way you're doing it is just definitely, you're going to be one of the only ones. But in that same time, you're setting a lot of records, doing a lot of first descents, and wow, that's just amazing. So when you're going up, so like your day-to-day trip, what kind of gear do you have to place? How much food, how much water, and how long are you in the air? Like, what are you different from like a day hiker that's on the same mountain?
Sure. Like, for example, on ISTA, a typical trip to go and summit a volcano would involve at least 2 nights at base camp, or 1 night at base camp and then 1 night on a higher camp. especially for people that are coming from lower altitudes.
Yeah.
Because in Mexico City, I already have an advantage because I'm in here and in my home, I'm already at like 7,000 feet elevation. So, dang. I mean, that's higher than Denver and almost as high as like Aspen Snowmass.
I live at 6 and you're 1,000 feet higher than me. Dang.
Yeah. Yeah. So some people even, you know, get altitude sickness just coming to Mexico City, right? So there I have already an advantage. But if you're not coming from here, you would fly into Mexico City and spend the night here ideally, and then the next day make it out to base camp, which is like almost 13,000 feet, and you can get there by car. It's pretty accessible. So it's a lot of elevation gain in one day, going from 7,000 to 13,000. And then the next day, people usually just take it easy so their body acclimatizes, maybe do a short hike, and maybe the following night start their summit bit. And it's like an alpine start at like maybe 2 a.m., 3 a.m., really early in the morning. And they'll usually take a really light backpack because you can do your summit bit all the way down from base camp in a single day and back. And they'll probably take maybe, depending on the speed of the group, but like, let's say 5 hours to get to the summit, to spend an hour there, and then maybe 3 hours, 4 hours to come back. So it's around a 10-hour day on the mountain at altitude. So it's like a 3-day trip almost. And they'll usually take a light pack, so maybe like around maybe 2 liters of water. And all in all, with, you know, the crampons and the ice axe, you know, the extra clothing and your snacks and whatnot, probably, you know, less than 12 pounds of equipment, less than 10 pounds. So you go as light as possible. And if you want to do a hike and fly, that you'll probably have to take more than twice as much gear and weight. So my gear with, you know, my hiking plus the paragliding gear, all in all, is probably like a little over 25 pounds.
Okay, not terrible.
Yeah,
not terrible. Almost like a backpacker.
Yeah, exactly, like a backpacker. Except I'm really a pretty short and skinny guy, so I weigh like less than 120 pounds. So I really feel the weight.
Yeah, for sure.
Dang. Yeah, and at altitude, every step is a deep breath that you have to take.
Right.
So it takes me, like, for example, if hiking with that pack versus for me hiking without my paragliding equipment, it takes me maybe 40% longer to make the hike up.
Oh, wow.
And then you have to be prepared to hike back down again if the conditions aren't right.
How often does that happen for you?
For me, it doesn't happen often. It's only happened to me once, and then I've done 6 flights on the high volcanoes. So one out of 7, I had to hike back down. The reason for this is that I really pick my days, and in terms of the weather conditions and the wind. So if the day before the conditions don't look good, I just won't go, and I save myself the trouble. And also, since these are all mountains that I've been on previously, I also have a pretty good idea of where I can take off from, and I think it's at all possible or not. So if I were going on a mountain that I've never been on before, the ratio would be really different. And or if I were going on a trip abroad somewhere where you have to commit to a weekend or a certain date and you know, hope for the best in terms of the weather, that would also be a really different ratio. So I try to take advantage of the fact that I have all these volcanoes really close to home, and you can really take advantage of that.
Man, those are such big mountains, man. That's so cool.
Yeah. You know,
we pride ourselves on big mountains here in Colorado, but those just dwarf it. Like they dwarf it, because our biggest mountains are only 14,000 feet. You've been on a 20,000 footer doing this down in Peru, and right next to your home is an 18.5. That's just crazy.
Yeah.
Now, you don't think about Mexico City being such a high elevation mountainous city, but it's right there.
Yeah, you wouldn't think so. And I mean, a lot of people are surprised to see there's glaciers in Mexico, you know, not many. I mean, there's only 3 of them left, but we're so a lot closer to the equator, but the mountains are so high that It's still pretty cold up there.
Dang, that's so crazy. So you said that for most people, it's 2 days, two nights and 3 days. How in the world do you take a 3-day trip for most people and get it into same day out your front door and back?
That's a great question. So since I have a full-time job and a family, and I have really limited vacation time, and I also want to spend time at home, I started to looking for ways to actually make these kinds of trips shorter, especially trips abroad, like that trip to Peru. And when I was doing the research on altitude acclimatization, I found that some people were using like a hypoxic generator to acclimatize at home. So it's the machine that you plug in, and it's about, I don't know, maybe like 2.5 feet tall and probably the size of a medium-sized trash can that you have in the kitchen. And what that does, it scrubs the oxygen or part of the oxygen from the air and substitutes nitrogen in its place. And then you hook that up to either a mask that you wear while you are at rest or exercising, or to a little plastic tent that you sleep in at night. It simulates, the lack of oxygen that you will find at altitude.
So, yeah, which one do you do?
When I went to Peru, what I did is I got the tent, and it's like it covers your body from your chest up, and I slept in that for like 6 weeks before going on the trip. And then you gradually start to increase the simulated altitude that you sleep in. Or they use the pulse oximeter, so it's a little device like they have in the hospitals. You clip it onto your fingertip, and it measures not only your pulse or your heart rate, but also your blood oxygen saturation. So how saturated your blood is with oxygen in terms of percentage. So here in Mexico City, if I were at rest, my blood oxygen reading would probably be close to like 95-96%. And if you're at sea level, it's like 98-99%. And the higher up you go, the more it starts to drop. And when you sleep in the tent, in order to get your body to sufficiently stressed so that it has to adapt, you try to maintain it below 90 and ideally above 80, so you can actually get some rest at night as well.
Yeah, because I mean, does it affect your sleep?
Yeah, it does a little bit. So since you're not acclimatized yet, there's less oxygen in the air, and your body has to compensate for that somehow. So your first thing that your body does is it adjusts your breathing rate. So you'll be breathing in more air per minute than normal, and then your heart will start to work overtime also to compensate. So your resting heart rate at night, it'll go up as well. So your heart will be working more during the whole night compared to what the work that it would normally have to do. So your body has to work a little bit harder just to maintain that same or similar level of oxygenation in your blood.
So was it a hard decision to decide to buy one of those, or was it like, this is it, this is what I need to be able to do this and still maintain work and family and not take too much vacation time off?
Yeah, for me, I think I had my doubts because I hadn't tried it. In the U.S., there are probably some, high-tech, training facilities where people might have access to one and try it out. But here, I really had to commit and buy one up front. There's some mountaineering agencies that will actually rent it out to their clients for certain expeditions.
Oh, wow.
But I had to buy it. And in hindsight, I mean, it's been a great investment. I mean, it saved me so much time. And I mean, at different points in life, if you want to live a life with some adventure in it, you're going to need time, and you're going to need, money and resources. And sometimes some lucky people will have both at the same time. Most probably won't. And you might have one and not the other. Right? So, if I had all the time in the world, I would just go out and spend a couple of weeks at altitude in Peru or here and get fully acclimatized, and that's the most effective thing you can do. But if you don't have the time, then you have to make up for it in a different way. And for me, it's been really worth it. I mean, in Peru, what we did out there was usually like a 2-week trip. I went out there with a friend who lives in another city, which is lower in elevation, and he had to go out there a week before I did to get acclimatized. So before the big peak that we climbed, that's, you know, close to 21,000 feet, he climbed another one that's around 17,000. So that really helped him. And he spent also a couple of nights at a little town in the middle of the Cordillera that's called Huaraz, which is also quite high. It's like maybe 10,000 feet. Wow. So that also helps. And I was able to, you know, drop in a week after him and go directly up to the base camp of the mountain and follow the regular schedule from then onwards.
You didn't fly off that peak, did you?
No, that would have been great. It wouldn't have been possible because the weather turned really bad. By the time we were at the summit, we had, you know, it was a ping pong ball of weather. We couldn't see anything, just a few feet in front of us. So, and I mean, that's the thing. If my plan had been to go out and fly off the summit, I would have had to stay a lot longer to wait for a good weather window or just hope to be really lucky. And in that case, I would have had to carry my equipment all the way up and back down again because the weather was terrible.
Jeez.
And then back then I hadn't started flying yet, so that wasn't on the radar. But I would love to go back and do something like that over there.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that helped make this show possible. This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's cowboy boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and the friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, that's fine. Just go to tecovas.com. That's tecovas.com. They offer free shipping on all boots as well as free returns and exchanges. They ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today and get ready for this summer. If you ever thought, can I pull off a pair of cowboy boots? Then you should pull on a pair of Tecovas and you'll see. They'll become your new favorite footwear. Cowboys knew what they were doing when they invented this Western wear. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. Has anything ever gone wrong after getting in the air or calculations or did anything ever go close to going bad?
When I flew off of Orizaba, the one that's like 18,000 feet, 18,500, the wind was stronger than what was forecasted the previous day. And I saw the forecast change the day I was climbing up. So it was probably like at my very limit in terms of how much wind I could handle on takeoff. So I really thought twice about it and took me a while to finally decide to give it a shot. I mean, and everything turned out okay, but once I was in the air, gone up by myself, so my car was at the base camp, and I had to get back to my car, you know, somehow. And the wind was so strong that on my glider, which is a beginner glider, the beginner gliders aren't very good at flying upwind, at penetrating the wind. So if, let's say, there's something called the trim speed of the glider, so that means, you know, how fast will it move forwards, what speed, if you're not touching anything, you're just letting it fly by itself, and that might be like maybe close to a little under 30 kilometers an hour. So if the wind is 30 kilometers an hour and your trim speed is 30 kilometers an hour and you try to go upwind, you're just gonna slowly fall straight down with no forward speed. So the wind, once I took off a little and I got a little away from the mountain, so I had, you know, plenty more air below me and more space behind me in case something went wrong. But I realized I wasn't penetrating the wind at all. So in the air, I had to decide if I was going to turn away from the volcano. And I mean, I could have flowed down, but I would have had to look for a field or somewhere to land in a place I hadn't planned to land. And usually I try to go out and scout possible landing fields beforehand, so I know where I'm going and I know what options I have, so I don't have to make that decision on the spot. So that was one option, and then I would have run into the problem of having to find my car afterwards somehow. So that's not very practical.
right.
And the car was, I mean, at over 13,000 feet on the mountain, so it would have been a long way to get back to it. And the other option was to try and land on the volcano. So I hadn't planned on landing on the volcano, and I had to land at about a little over 2,000 feet below the summit. So landing at 16,000 feet is still pretty high. I landed on the slope, and it was the landing was really easy because it was kind of like volcanic sand, so it was really soft. When there's wind, and if you land into the wind, then the landing is really soft because the wind takes away all your speed or most of it. So it was a soft landing on a slope, but then I had to pack my glider in a really uncomfortable place with a really, really steep incline with sand everywhere. And it's also still pretty high up, so every small effort really, really tiring. And then after that, I had to carry all the equipment across the volcano and traverse to find, well, to get to the route that I had climbed up to, so I could go back down and get back to my car. So that was not really a hike and fly. It was like a hike and fly and then hike some more.
That's funny.
So it took me longer to fly down than it would have taken to just start climbing back down after reaching the summit.
Oh my god!
Because of all of that, but it was still quite an experience. And nothing. I mean, I didn't injure myself and didn't damage even the equipment or anything. It all worked out. It was just a few, and that flight, it was like 2,000, more than 2,000. Feet of descent, and that took like a minute and a half. Wow. So really, really, really fast. Like, because the air is so thin, everything happens a lot faster. The glider flies faster, and then your sink rate is higher. And if something happens to the wing, like if you get a small collapse or something, that it also happens faster, and you have to react quicker. So everything went well. It was just a little more time consuming and tiring than it would have been if there were zero wind and I would have made it back to the landing that I had planned, you know, right beside the car. So I'll have to go back there again and do a longer flight, you know, because a minute and a half is really, really short, too short.
That is crazy. Yeah, there's my partner in business, he paraglides, and he tells me about it, and there's so much to consider. It's dangerous. It's a lot of calculations. You have to be pretty smart to put it all together and decide, is this possible for you to do, you know?
Yeah, it is for sure. I mean, if it's practiced safely and you have good proper instruction and you make decisions the way you're taught to make them, it can be really safe. People have been paragliding for a long time and never had accidents, you know, just like some people have been driving cars for, you know, decades and never had an accident. And there are other people that get into accidents all the time.
Right.
And then it's because people can get careless or go past their limits. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think a lot of it is the planning and the theory behind it and the practice. But there's also a component of being able to make decisions on the spot. And sometimes you have to make those decisions by yourself. Like, even if you have like a radio when you're learning and your instructor is coaching you and you have his voice in your ear, but then, you know, eventually you start flying by yourself. And if you get into a situation, then you have to get yourself out of it, right? You know, in the same way that happens in other sports, right? Like when I was rock climbing and I was climbing on a multi-pitch route, and then the rope got stuck when we were like 1,000 feet up a wall, so, and nobody can help you there either. To deal with the situation as it presents itself.
So do you know what the highest peak that's ever been hiked and flown?
Yeah, Everest.
Really?
Everest, yeah.
Someone hiked up there and flew off the top?
Yeah, a couple of people have actually. Surprisingly, like the first paragliding flight from Everest was in the late 80s, quite a while ago. Back then, paragliding was very, very new sport. And I mean, the gliders back then were dangerous back then. They were a lot less stable and they would be prone to collapsing, and their glide rate was not good. So they would sink pretty fast. So it was harder landings and at that altitude, harder still. So it was an amazing feat for the time. And since then, other people have flown from the summit. That's another level. And then there's people doing, if anyone wants to look into this, I think it's fascinating. There's two French pilots, Antoine Girard and Damien Lacaze. They were recently in Pakistan in the Karakoram, like the Himalaya, and they did a cross-country traverse. So multiple days flying, many miles each day in the mountain range. They flew really close to a couple of the 8,000 meter peaks up there. And then the idea was to land on a 7,000 meter mountain. It's called Spantik. So they landed on the mountain face at like 6,000 meters. And the idea was to do a summit attempt after landing and then fly off again. And they got pretty close to the summit, but then they had problems with the altitude. And Antoine had started to get symptoms of a cerebral edema, so they turned around and went back down, and they flew off the next day. But I think they, under different circumstances, with good weather and without that incident with the altitude sickness, they would have been able to summit and then fly off again. It's like a regular expedition would have taken a couple of weeks just to reach, the initial spot where they landed on the mountain.
Wow.
So that's like the cutting edge of what's possible with a piece of fabric and some mountaineering equipment.
So for you, what's that dream goal? What are you hoping to, what's the biggest thing on your bucket list with this sport?
So for now, my second flight on ISTA, instead of just flying straight down, I the first flight, it lasted like 12 minutes, really emotional, exciting flight, and everything went well. And after that, I'd already learned how to, use thermals to stay up in the air longer. I hadn't really done any big cross-country flights or anything like that, but I could thermal well enough. So I tried to go back out there again on a day where I thought I was going to be able to find some thermals. And sure enough, I did, and I was able to fly, for an hour above the volcano. So it was incredible to just fly over the whole route that I had just hiked up a couple hours before that. It took me 5 hours to go up, and then in a couple minutes, I flew over the entire route. And that was a beautiful, beautiful experience for me. So I wanna do more of those flights here, because I don't think anybody had ever done that before on that mountain. And then the other mountains where I just barely probably did the first descent, and I wanna not just fly down, but enjoy the views a little longer and fly over the mountains. In Europe and other places where this is more common, people also do what they call top landing. So you can take off from somewhere lower and then land on the summit with your paraglider. So kind of like climbing it with your paraglider instead of hiking up. I don't think anyone's ever done that on these mountains here. So that's something that would be really cool to do as well. And then mixing, like the next level for me would be mixing the cross country flying with hike and fly, and going on a trip, like a multi-day trip where you fly and hike and actually cover some good distance. And that's what I want to work up to. So that's something that's called Volbiv. You had like Nick Nanens on the show, and he's done a lot of that. And that's something I aspire to do as well.
So crazy. Well, congratulations on, you know, learning how to do this pretty quickly, accelerating the sport in your area. And I hope you do some firsts, like never been done from mountain to mountain. That would just, you could circle the whole city. Man, that's just crazy. That's so awesome. How can people keep in touch with you and follow your trips and what you do?
Sure. I'm on Instagram as, it's in Spanish, so I'll spell it out. It's called Poncho el Piloto, like Poncho the Pilot. So it's PONCHEL, and then Pilot with an O in the end, PILOTO, Poncho el Piloto, on Instagram.
Perfect. Well, we'll link that in the show notes when we release it. But man, what an interesting sport. What an interesting thing to get into.
It is.
And the fact that you're doing so much to make it to where you can do it in a third of the time that it takes other people, that is that's dedication. And that's what it takes when times of life, like you have a newborn, you have a family, you have responsibilities. It might not be like this forever, but like for now, you love the sport enough that you're going to chase it by doing what you have to do to still get out there and maintain that stoke.
Yeah, having limited resources is a great motivation to get creative.
Absolutely. You know, if you were rich sitting on top of one of the mountains and with all the time in the world, man, you probably wouldn't do anything. You'd probably just sit there.
Exactly. We need a little bit of pressure and those kinds of incentives sometimes. But yeah, I think it's great that a sport like this, and sometimes, you know, we think that everything's already been done, you know, and, you know, a lot of things have been done, but I mean, I'm sure that if people like look around where their hometown or the places they frequently visit, and for sure, there's a lot of things that could be first in some way. And it doesn't have to be a first for the whole world, but if it's a first for you, it's the same level of excitement and accomplishment too.
Absolutely, man. I tell people it's like songs, you know. You'd think with all the songs that are out in all of history, every good song's ever been written already. But good ones come out every day, man. Like good music comes out every single day. There's some first out there that you would be stoked to chase, and it's not even on anybody's radar yet. So
for sure,
keep it up, man. You're definitely one of those people that are making that happen. That's so cool. Well,
thanks, man. Making good music, I like that.
Yeah. I mean, there'll never be an end to good songs. There'll never be an end to what you can do first, something adventurous. So, Adrian, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Mason. It's great talking.
Yeah, and keep us updated on what you do next. We'll post your Instagram, and yeah, man, congratulations again on being a father. Maybe one day you'll take your little girl up there with you.
Oh, for sure. That's got to be in the plans. And congratulations ahead of time to you too. And keep doing what you're doing with this podcast and getting people to share their stories. I'll be listening too.
Awesome. All right. Have a good one, man.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. See ya. First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.